We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovic. Joining me today is Bob Coleman, Adrian Day, Keith Weiner, and Vince Lancey. We're having a discussion today about Basel III and the potential ramifications. So this is going to be kind of a roundtable to get each of their thoughts, where they agree, where they disagree, and really just try and dig down into what this is going to mean ultimately for gold and the dollar. So Bob Coleman is joining us from Idaho Armored Vaults. Thanks for joining us today, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Adrian Day is chairman and CEO of Adrian Day Asset Management. Hi, Adrian. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Keith Weiner is CEO of Monetary Metals. How are you today, Keith?
Doing good, Tom. Howdy.
And Vince Lancey is founder of Echo Bay Partners. Thanks for joining us, Vince.
Thanks for having me.
So on June 28th, the new Basel III regulations come into effect for most banks. So this changes the net stable funding ratio for gold when held as a tier one asset on a bank's balance sheet. And it changes it from 50 to 85%. This is being done ideally to make banks stronger and more resilient in times of crisis. So let's start by getting your thoughts on these changes. Maybe Keith, let's start with you.
So first of all, let me kind of define some of the terms. Tier one refers to the bank's capital. That's the liability side, although it also includes equity. And then what banks do is they raise capital in order to buy assets. The assets presumably pay a higher return than their cost of capital, depending on what source the capital might be. And then the bank makes the spread, you know, in the middle. So what Basel III does is continuing the theme of, I call it compensation, doing the wrong thing on purpose allegedly to fix something somewhere else that you cannot or will not fix the right way, like letting the air out of three tires if you have a flat. So we have an irredeemable currency, we have central planning of that currency, and we have unstable interest rate, among other problems, and that led to the crisis in 2008. So naturally what they do is they say, well, we're going to compensate for that by trying to somehow micromanage the banks. They call it macroprudential regulation. To somehow make sure that things will be stable should our regime of central planning ever cause another 2008, which isn't going to happen anyway, but should that ever happen, we're going to try to make the banks somehow be more stable. So in order to do that, they look at both the asset side and on the asset side, you know, risks to the bank. On the asset side, you obviously have default risk. You also have market volatility or price risk. And on the funding side, which people don't really think about that much, there's the risk of think in a crisis, the funding markets for banks seized up. You couldn't sell commercial paper. There's a lot of things you couldn't do. Repo, although now you can repo to the Fed, but that wasn't the way it was back then. So the bank may have its funding source dry up, which basically means its loans are being called. And what is it going to do with the asset if the market for that asset suddenly goes no bid? So they look at this environment and they say, okay, for each kind of asset that you're going to buy, we want to try to dictate what percentage of the funding to buy that asset is going to be so-called stable funding, which is not not demand deposits from retail, not, you know, overnight funding and repo and all those things, longer term sources of funding, such as longer term bonds, bank equity, et cetera. So what Basel III is essentially saying is that, as a percentage is 85%, if I recall, it's been a while since I've read the regulation, 85% of the funding to buy, to have gold as an asset on the balance sheet is to come from so-called stable funding and not anything overnight or demand, keeping in mind that the business model of a bank is euphemistically called maturity transformation. Borrowing short to lend long or duration mismatch. They like to use short-term funding because it's cheap to buy long-term assets because long-term assets generally have a higher yield. And now the regulators are saying to have gold as an asset on the balance sheet, you need long-term stable funding. The net result of this is it increases the opportunity cost to the bank to own gold, which is going to make the bank more reluctant to be involved in the gold trade. And that is the long and short of what the regulation is actually saying.
So when we think about the bank not wanting to basically participate in that trade, Keith, is that ultimately going to be positive or negative for gold?
Well, for me, and I tend to think a lot more about spread than price. You know, it's easy to say, well, the banks aren't going to speculate on the gold price. I'm not sure they do a lot of that anyway. And I know that I disagree with a lot of folks in the gold community on that point. But think about now, you know, from the perspective of somebody who's getting some gold financing from a bank, whether it's a gold mining company or a gold refiner, a mint, a bullion dealer, a jeweler. What we've done is we've just driven up the cost to the bank to be in this trade, which is going to do, you know, it's going to compress the bank's margin, basically. And then the bank is either going to pull out of the trade altogether. And by the way, we're in a long-term trend of banks pulling out of this exact trade. Rothschilds pulled out, Deutsche Bank pulled out. I think it was BNP Paribas or Credit Agricole, maybe both pulled out. And most recently, Scotia Mercado pulled out. So we're just, you know, I call it useless ingredients. When the regulators say, you know, in order to be allowed to sell a hamburger, which is normally a bun and a piece of meat, now you have to put in all of these other things like ADA compliant bathrooms and, you know, track your supply chain back to, you know, infinity and so forth. It just adds cost in a way that the consumer doesn't value or even know about. That's what we're doing here. So what you may find as a retail gold or silver investor is you go to your coin shop and the price to buy that gold eagle or that silver eagle is higher than you expected, but it's not really an increase in the premium, it's an increase in the offer price. If you were to turn right back around the same instant before the price of the metal moved, what you would get is a lower bid. And so there's a greater frictional loss, there's a wider bid-ask spread than there was before. And that's going to be a consequence of the fact that it's harder for them to get funding at all. And then when they do, you know, the price of that funding is greater than it was. So that's the net. So it's going to be an increase in friction. It'll make gold and silver perhaps a bit less liquid is the net result on it. Now, will that make people want to buy it more? Because people perversely say, well, if the government wants to make this more frictional, then I'm going to perversely say, well, damn the torpedoes, I'm going to buy more. It might, or it might make institutional investors more reluctant because they know that they think of it in terms of slippage. I get in and out of a position and there's some losses, you know, execution slippage, and they may be more reluctant. So, you know, it could go either way in terms of that.
Anybody have anything to add there?
Yeah, I would add, and I've been saying that the London market, like you've seen the bullion banks pulling out of the business. Part of this has been a long-term trend since you've had royalty financing companies and so forth that have been getting involved in the financing for mines and so forth. You don't have the bank commodity trading desks as prevalent as it was maybe 10 or 20 years ago. So from that perspective, it's a natural occurrence to see the deleveraging of the London market, and you've seen it in the COMEX as well. You've seen a lot of deleveraging. For instance, in 2016, you had 500 or 300 to 1 in terms of paper contracts to physical metal in the registered category, and now it's down to 2.65 to 1 is the ratio. So you've seen a contraction there. You know, the COMEX has become more of a collateral. You know, a lot of that metal that may have came from London was leaving the markets there because maybe that, you know, not just the arbitrage that was taken advantage of last year, but also potentially for collateral financing because the banks are pulling out. So from my standpoint, if everyone has, you know, we've always, as gold investors, said, listen, when is the physical market going to take over the paper markets? Well, this is what it looks like. You have the trading desks backing away from the market becoming the metal moving into stronger hands, and you're going to see probably more volatility. You know, just simply, just like watching Bitcoin or Rhodium, you know, things that don't have a traditional hedging market If less players are involved in it, you're going to have just simply more price movement, which is not a bad thing. Over time, if the demand and supply, or I should say demand, continues to stay strong, that'll be more of a precursor to push prices higher.
And interestingly, Bob, as you mentioned, the London markets, the LBMA has been granted an extension to January 1st, 2022 to have to comply with these rules. And everybody else seems to be implementing them at the end of June of this month. So why do they need this extension?
I think part of that was because of the euro and the Brexit scenario, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Being British, we just don't want to do everything on the same schedule as the EU. So, but as you probably know, the biggest impact is on the LBMA, not on, commercial banks. The idea that commercial banks are going to run out and buy, hundreds of pounds of gold to stick in their reserves, I think, is wishful thinking. I think the biggest impact is on the LBMA, and as London Bullion Market Association, and as you know, the LBMA has asked to be exempted from these rules altogether. And, I don't pretend to be an expert on the London forward market, but it strikes me that that is not an unreasonable request, because the London bullion banks, essentially, they have, their long contracts, their short contracts, they match their forward contracts. You don't have a lot of, you don't have defaults, and the market moves smoothly, it works smoothly. But if you're going to insist that a bullion bank has to have physical gold on one side of its balance sheet to match the forward liability on the other side, it makes it totally impractical. So the net result of this, as I understand, is that the bullion banks, the London the bullion dealers before of the LBMA, in all likelihood, the rest of them will exit the market, just as the ones we've seen have exited, and because it's just totally impractical. So you'll leave that market to a handful of commercial banks, big commercial banks, for whom the London forward market is an insignificant part of their business. And so I don't think it's extreme to think that the LBMA, may virtually disappear. And that's important because of the hedging it provides for producers, for refiners, and other sellers of the metal. And of course, the LBMA has also provided traditionally a lot of swaps with the COMEX. So a lot of the volume on the COMEX ultimately comes from the London forwards market because of the swaps. Obviously you'll get hedging. You'll get hedging from, the producer that wants to sell, and hedging from the jewelry manufacturer that wants to buy. But the volumes without the banks, without the bullion banks being involved, will be considerably, considerably lower.
I don't know. So 85% reserve requirement is up there with equities. So shouldn't gold be considered less risky than equities?
That was the argument the LBMA made, is that there's no default risk, where sometimes equities just go belly up and you find out that the company is hollowed out or even a fraud or whatever. And, there's no risk that gold suddenly goes no bid. Or other problems like that should be treated as a much lower risk asset. But that's the world that we're in at the moment.
I think it's important to note that the unallocated position is just simply a general liability account, not necessarily physical metal backing like an allocated type of account. So with them reducing the unallocated, I guess, trading per se, that's all part of this deleveraging, which is what Keith kind of mentioned. It increases the cost because you're actually now having to, you can't multiply or fractionally reserve or leverage off of that, maybe that 400 ounce gold bar in the vault and sell, thousands of ounces off of it for instance, you start to tighten up the market, or the supply and demand issues, I think, start to come more into play. And that's why I keep looking at rhodium and some of these other markets that don't have as big of a hedging and derivatives market. The question is, not that the hedging will go away by no means, but with less players involved, you have more pure price discovery, I guess you could say.
Well, the hedging becomes more expensive. So think of the problem of a jewelry manufacturer who buys $50 million worth of gold and then spends 3 weeks turning it into beautiful pieces of jewelry. So you borrow $50 million, you buy $50 million worth of gold. Gold has a bad price day like it did today. And now you don't have a $50 million asset anymore. Now you have $47 million asset. You're bankrupt. You have to hedge that. You cannot... you can't borrow money to buy an asset without the hedging. And so if the cost of the hedging goes up, then that eats into the margins of the jeweler. And so the marginal jeweler will be forced out of the business. So the same thing will happen in minting, same thing will happen in refining, the same thing will happen in bullion dealing. It'll just kill the marginal players in that industry. And then everyone else has to raise their markup, to retail to somehow recover the cost that just went up for them. Now, I have to say, Monetary Metals is in this business of financing these guys with loans to mining companies and leases to, refiners and net jewelers and all that. So we stand to benefit from this. But as a free market guy, I always want to go on the record and say I don't want the government to squash anybody, even if they're my competition. I think we should have a free market. And I just see all of this as just... when the government intrudes into a market, they add friction, which means fewer transactions, fewer people can benefit, and the marginal participant is forced out because they can't make enough money to stay alive.
Go ahead, Vince.
It's a lot of cool stuff, actually. Just trying to tie it all together so I can wrap my own head around it. It sounds like what they're doing is they're fracturing a liquidity pool. So let's say you've got 10 people who make a market, so 10 people who create liquidity for, we'll just make it simple. You have 10 people who create liquidity for jewelers, and their cost basis is going to go up to run the business. And that you'll probably see everyone said it, you'll see a consolidation in the industry at the bullion dealer level, either drop out or it flows into low cost producers who can either do it at a low cost or do it as a loss leader. So you end up creating a situation not unlike heating oil and gasoline and palladium. You move towards a more fractured, but then consolidated in a smaller, cartel is not the right word, but into a more of an old boys network. And the problem with that is the cost gets passed on, as Keith said. The cost gets passed on to downstream, and ultimately in the hands of the retail. So you're probably going to see consolidation in the industry at several levels. And disturbingly enough, as Bob and Adrian were saying, we're going to have, as a person who's managing that risk, because there's less leverage, because leverage is not all bad, and because there's less interest, and because you have the virtuous cycle, the snowball effect in reverse, you'll end up seeing this. If I'm purely as a tactical trader, if I am able to do 100 contracts, a dime wide, because I can manage that risk, I'm now going to exaggerate, 10 contracts, a dollar wide, because to keep my same risk parameters based on the volatility and my same profits or profit margins, potential profit margins, I'm not going to be involved in the market as much anymore. And that's what I'm hearing from everything here. So it's actually a little bit frightening. It's not as, it may be good ultimately, but if you made a lot of money in palladium, good luck getting out of it. I don't want it to be a palladium type of market. Mm-hmm.
I think it's also important to note that Keith's in the business of leasing and so forth, but if the market becomes less leveraged, the ability to get your physical metal back, becomes also a potential risk. So you have it changes that dynamics, just like Vincent said, of the market structure, which, you know, from an investor standpoint, like I run a hedge fund that's also in physical gold, silver. From my perspective, I think it's going to be longer term, as long as demand stays strong, it's going to start to push the market higher, irregardless of what the hedging practice is and what the industry, the other types of transactions that are involved in the business that currently may actually provide some type of pressure on the price when you go in with a big hedge or something like that.
The price will be a better proxy for the value now. That could be ultimately what we get out of this, hopefully.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all read, I'm sure, a lot of the articles floating around on the internet that sort of suggests that somehow all the banks, JP Morgan, Citibank, they're all going to suddenly go out and convert all of their paper gold to physical gold and hold it in their reserves for the next 100 years. And, you know, that's just plain nonsense for a lot of reasons. I mean, one reason, if you think about it, if I have paper gold and these new rules come in, there's one of two things I can do. I can either convert the paper gold to physical, so you know that improves the gold position, or I can say, oh, screw it, I'll just get rid of this paper gold. So there's two ways that can go. But more importantly than that, of course, are two things. One is that there are a lot of ways that banks can improve their tier one reserves without even touching gold. There's a lot of ways they can do it. So, you know, we in the gold business, we're all focused on gold, and Basel III comes out and changes the ratio of gold. And suddenly, you know, suddenly people go crazy saying, oh, everyone's going to buy gold. But there's lots of other assets they can buy for their tier one reserves. And the other thing to remember is that banks in Europe, Britain, and the United States, which are the main regions participating in this Basel III, they have excess reserves right now. So they don't have to do a thing. Most of them, I mean, you look at US banks, for example, they have $1.6 trillion in reserves, $400 billion are required. So you can shrink the amount of reserves significantly without even without forcing them to buy anything else. The other point I would make, so I think it's just extreme sort of nonsense, frankly, but it's extreme to think that it's going to have a wild, bank buying is going to have a wild move on gold. The other thing I would say is that as we saw today and yesterday, there are, you know, half a dozen far more significant, far more significant factors affecting gold price than, the Basel III.
Yeah, that's one thing that has really piqued my interest or that I've been thinking of quite a lot about in preparation for this interview is if they've had so long to prepare for this, and yes, the deadline is the end of June, but you know, we've been talking about the start of these regulations coming out of the great financial crisis. It's not like the banks are going to run out at the end of June and go position themselves all of a sudden. This is not going to be this catalyzing event. Am I wrong?
No,
I do think one thing, though. I mean, they had postponing the deadline over and over again. And so it's really only been, I don't know, someone correct me. I think it's really only been pretty much this year, but it's been, okay, it really is coming in June. Mm-hmm. But still, that's not, it's not a one-day event by any means.
It's not a surprise. It's not like everybody suddenly has to react on short notice.
Mm-hmm. Right,
If anybody wanted to change their position as a result of the coming Basel III, they've had certainly many months to change that position and no particular reason to do it on June 28 or July 1. They would, you know, probably prepare in advance.
One of the other questions that was brought up in preparation here, Bob, you might be able to speak to this, is will the COMEX be able to cope with any additional physical demand if we see delivery is enforced?
What do you mean in terms of people wanting to stand for delivery or metal coming onto the COMEX?
Metal coming onto the COMEX, and then if these banks, like I said, they're obviously going to position themselves over time. But if we have this smaller market and there is more delivery that needs to happen, what is, let's say, the depth of their ability to deliver on this gold?
Well, I think it's important to note what happened last year. You saw a lot of refiners and users of metal, played the arbitrage game. They put their metal onto the COMEX and started rolling contracts and catching the spreads and so forth. But some of those players actually are not as reluctant to just give up that metal. Of course, now the premiums have jumped, like on silver, you had 1,000-ounce bar premiums, they're elevated and so forth. So it's actually beneficial for them to actually not roll the contract, but actually, deliver it to a fabricator or user for the metal. But what's happening, though, is that you don't have the open interest, for example, is not as high as it was pre-COVID. So you don't have as many players involved. And so the ones that have actually delivered the metal are using the COMEX in a different fashion than maybe the COMEX was being used before as a paper leverage trading hedging type strategy scenario. Now it's being run more by the people that have sold. The ones that are short potentially could have also been the ones that dumped a lot of metal onto the market. I mean, last year was an extreme amount of inventory that came onto the market. And now that's slowly coming off, but that's coming off and it's being demanded by, users that actually are making product with it, especially to meet the investment demand. So the dynamics have changed a little bit. And those refiners that are making that metal that can make delivery onto the COMEX, they now control the markets a little bit more than simply, going and delivering that metal to, for instance, a bullion bank, and the bullion bank doing that same type of trade. But now you have it directly the refiner that's doing that, if that kind of helps.
Mm-hmm. Vince, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, just to what Bob said right away, the refiners definitely started flexing muscle last year. And I think you're talking about in March when silver and gold COMEX went premium over spot, and that was a venue squeeze. But just to keep it simple, you're seeing that I'm not sure what the word is, refiner, smelter, but people that fabricate have a lot of power. And I think that was, an important moment. And the other thing I wanted to add was going back to the market structure, we'll come back to that some other time, but the what's probably happening now is you're probably going to see more, it's less profitable to be short. If you're a bank, it doesn't mean it's profitable to be long. And so you'll have less shorts to cover, less volumes to do, and the COMEX will be used in a different fashion. I think that's, we're moving towards that now. So there you go.
So what about ramifications for the dollar? Does anybody have any thoughts towards how this will affect the US dollar?
That's a little bit larger macro, I guess, of a picture in terms of competitive devaluation, who's printing the most currency at any moment. And yet you have a lot of gamesmanship that's been played, especially the last couple of days with, are they tapering? It's actually talking about tapering, or, I mean, there's a lot of verbal pushing, I guess, that's going on right now, but not a lot of action. I mean, the action in the reverse repo market, for example, this massive amount, I think we hit over $700 billion today, is just a confluence of how much money has been paid down by U.S. T-bills by the Treasury Department since late February, when the bond market started to crack. And I think the Treasury came out and said, listen, we got to do something with the $1.6 trillion that we have sitting at the Fed. Let's just pay down our T-bills and hope that some of that rolls into longer dated paper to try to support the treasury market and support the primary dealers, because the primary dealers were leveraged and they were probably bleeding as well, you know, holding a lot of debt. Yes, they could be hedged, but the degree of amount of leverage that they're using, if prices started to fall apart on the fixed income market, that could be devastating for the banks, because you know, they don't mark to market their bond position on their balance sheet. And that could also be one of the reasons why gold is becoming more of a, you know, they're deleveraging gold, because potentially if you start to see inflation rip through the system and the fixed income market starts to fall apart, you know, at some point gold is the king of currencies again.
So are you, can I clarify that? Are you suggesting, Bob, that this, the motive for introducing the rules as they affect gold is in fact to delever gold? That's a deliberate motive that the bank, that the central banks had?
Well, I think it is, because the system is so leveraged at this point, they have to be able to, when this thing starts to spiral, like Vince said, you're going to have less counterparties, and with less counterparties, you aren't going to be able to clear trades and so forth. So you got to somehow contract this market and control the beast, I guess you could say.
Okay. I just didn't know that central banks thought far enough ahead.
Well, maybe they don't, but I'm sure the banks that are in the business of actually, you know, dealing with, I guess, the counterparties and so forth, I guess that's really the risk I see, is systemic and counterparty risk, and that's what they may be trying to control. And by getting out of the unallocated position, or maybe dissuading that activity, you know, by you know, not being able to count unallocated positions as a heavier weighting to a balance sheet item, it's an indirect way of trying to reduce that leverage.
I'd like to. Okay, I'm sorry, Keith. You're up.
To a bank who's participating in this market, the unallocated gold is not the asset; it's a liability. They're not buyers of it; they're the ones selling that paper. And just to sell that paper, I mean, you're right. They don't necessarily have the gold bar sitting in the vault. They have a lease out to a refiner, or they have a loan out to a mining company who's producing the gold to deliver into it, and they're just arbitraging a couple of spreads. LIBOR to GOFO, and obviously the credit premium they charge versus the cost of the gold lease rate in the banking market. So it's not saying, hey, we don't want the banks to be leveraged to buy paper gold as much. It's forcing them out of the space. But to take a step back and look at this thing at the high level, you know, and if you read what Janet Yellen, let's say, was writing both as an academic at, I think she was at Berkeley, if I recall, and then what she was saying when she was president of the San Francisco Fed and later chair of the Federal Reserve was her title. These people really believe in this idea that they can macroprudential regulate and cause the banks not to be risky. Like, you know, in her writing, she understands that the bank has, you know, banks and pension funds and other big players have a certain nut that they have to hit in terms of rate of return. Otherwise, they're all insolvent because they have costs of doing business. They have to deliver return to their various stakeholders, especially pension funds, but also banks, insurance companies. She understands that. And she understands that by lowering the rate of interest, they've taken away the bank's ability to make their nut. And then she turns around and says, but we'll give them impose macroprudential regulation to keep them all safe, even in this perverse environment. They really believe that. And I've met a few central bankers, you know, not at the top level, not the Yellen or Powell level, but one to two levels down. These people really believe this shit. I mean, it's a deep, you know, blinders faith, you know, kind of thing. They don't really think about gold. That's the first observation. But then they think that they're making banks safe, you know, what did they say in World War II, making the world safe for democracy, making the banks safe for clients and money or whatever it is they would think. And then what happens is they say, okay, now we have to pass the next set of regulations. And so then it goes to all these committees and subcommittees that are writing, you know, churning out pages and pages and pages of this stuff. And you know, whether gold gets included or excluded from, you know, 85% NSFR is, you know, probably a committee decision even. In other words, don't attribute to malice aforethought what can be explained by, you know, incompetence and negligence and stupidity.
Or academic bias.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is a broader topic, of course, but, you know, one of the reasons that all these central banks bankers really do believe all this stuff, I didn't quite quote you completely, Keith, but it is a family show. One of the reasons they believe all this stuff is they're all academics. They all just talk to themselves. They only talk to themselves, and except when they have to go to Congress, when they're not listening even to congressmen, they're just telling them what they want. But they talk to themselves, and they're all academics. We don't have any businessmen or on the Federal Reserve Board, which I think is a huge mistake, a huge mistake.
There's I'd like to add something to that. There's a couple things. First, they are mostly academics, and rather than pile on the mentality, which, you know, it's very easy to do. I think it's low lying fruit for all of us. They believe, as you know, as people understand, they're not manipulative. Shepherds want to centralizers want to centralize, and they believe and you can see there's wisdom in this if you think that way. But the problem is, everything needs to be centralized to a point, but then pendulums swing too far, and then you're too far. So the cure for the banking crisis in 08 was, let's centralize the banks more and watch them closer, where you've destroyed counterparty diversity. And that's what's happened in gold as well. Now, the point that Bob made about gold would... I think what's going to happen with Basel III and gold is no one's going to be caught flat-footed. We're talking about it. We're not central bankers, but we're talking about it. I did work on this back in 2013, and I followed it from 2013 to 2020. And I stopped following because I knew it was not going to matter except as a trade for me. And in 2013, they were supposed to implement it in 2013. They delayed it because of Grexit. Not Brexit, Grexit. 2013, the banks weren't ready because they were worried about the Greek crisis. 2016, 2019, all those, they were delayed for different reasons. And when they finally settled on the Grexit problem, they gave them a 10-year loan to pay back. So here we are in 2021. And as I forget who said it, someone said, you know, we're in the perfect environment to do it. They have extra money on the balance sheet. Everybody has been is awash in liquidity. Now's the time to do it. So I don't think it's going to get delayed. But by the same token, like a stock listing or a stock split, it's buy the rumors, sell the news. And I'm not saying I'm bearish. What I'm saying is anybody who's hyping a big event is hyping it. They're worried about profits. That's it. They're not worried about investors. They're worried about, you know, they're fighting over, they want to fight over a carcass. They don't want to build a business. That's how I look at it.
Let me ask a question, if I may. I'll ask a question of the other three bright people on the, not the other three bright people, the three bright people on the panel. I'll ask you a question. To what extent do you think the move we had in gold from, you know, early March all the way through to last week, when during that entire period, we didn't have gold retreat more than two consecutive days, and we didn't have a more than 1.3 percentage points, I'm talking up until this recent week, to what extent was that buying from Basel III, whether it was conspiracy theorists, if I can call them that, but whether it was investors wanting to, you know, get ahead of the banks, or was it any bank buying? I mean, to what extent do you think that had anything at all to do with buying associated with Basel III?
You want to go first?
You're one of the bright three, so you go.
Well, I appreciate that. There's no accounting for taste on that. I could talk for a half hour on that, but just to I think get to the core point, especially the most recent events. Basel III has made anybody who's aware of it and who has not paid attention to it, it has caused a weak hands to strong hands move. So if you were a weak short, whether that be a fund or a small bank who really wasn't sure of your own reserves or balance sheet, you closed. And there was a short covering rally in gold 3 months ago for the June contract. But the last 3 months, there's a season out there, and I think you actually alluded to this, but I'll be very specific. There are a couple reasons that gold is rallying or had rallied. And one of them is major funds that have billions of dollars in many different assets, they punt in gold. You know, if it's above the 12-month moving average, let's throw some money in there. We don't care. And when they get in, they don't care if they distort it. When they get out, they don't care if they distort it. It's kind of it's an add-on for their bond desk. And I think you also had shorts covering. You had big players that punted a little bit, like on Brexit time. In Brexit, there was a lot of punting, front-running shorts, so to speak. And I think what we ran it, and you have, to indirectly answer your question about the dollar, gold has been also paying a lot more attention to notional negative interest rate bonds. It has been paying a lot of attention to negative real rates, which seemed to be very important for a while. And then they got more negative and gold stopped caring. And then they turn a little bit less negative and gold washes out. I think it's a comment on the personality of gold. But to answer the more recent events, the seasonality in gold, there actually is a lot of buying that comes into the August contract. And typically it actually seasonally makes a high, not the high, in August, September. And I think what we're seeing this week is specs who bought in anticipation of some event in gold being disappointed. And because of the reverse repos, because of the we're talking about tapering, the weak hands got stopped out. So you know, just to bring it back, the market follows a narrative only when it's convenient for the market, not for us. And I don't think Basel III matters in the short term. And I think the funds are about to find that out. Right. It's not going to affect the physical demand, though.
You know, to me, after Powell, after the Fed statement and Powell's comments, to me, the headline should have been, Fed will not raise interest rates for 2 years, says Powell. I mean, that to me was the news. Not that they maybe, perhaps might be thinking about maybe talking about it maybe 2 years from now, but we're not going to raise rates for 2 years. Now, if that had been the messaging, gold would have gone up probably. I don't know.
The market had already discounted that. I think that what happened is the change is, let's assume for the moment, right? We know it's not always true. Let's assume for the moment that most of the markets are efficient, or at least they're not efficient. They've discounted what they believe they know. No, I'm not an efficient market theorist, but I'm also going to, everyone's flow trading now. Whatever the market's trend is, whatever the Fed's trend is, everyone's going to pile into that flow. And there was a change in what they said. And the change isn't easy, but people that really like trade this stuff were paying attention to the fact that there was a change in sentiment, and it went from one hike in 2023 to two hikes. And they changed the IOER, which is the rate that has to govern the RRP. And these things, this is what was telegraphed that we should all look for next. Aside from everything that the market took to heart, what Powell said was, the last thing he said was, we will give you plenty of heads up before we taper. We will talk about it well before. And right now, this is what the market said. Oh, crap. They're going to talk about it at Jackson Hole in August. Let's get out now. Now, whether that's a dip to buy for the next 6 months, I don't know. Whether it's a dip to buy for the next 10 years, yes. But this market is reacting to thinner volumes, thinner exposure, as several of you brought up, in results of Basel III, and weak hands to strong hands. And you now have a Fed that's saying they're going to tighten. Now, they're probably going to tighten, and then we'll probably have negative interest rates 6 months later because it'll be a deflationary disaster. I don't think the market can take not being on all-time highs. Anyway, I spoke too much on it.
It'll be abortive short-term little tightened. Tom, can I share my screen? There's a graph I want to show of what the basis action has been in the last several months.
Yep, go ahead.
Let me, if I can, Oh, screen share.
Interestingly enough, guys, I just had a to a point that you brought up earlier, Keith, about this these kind of distorted markets. I just had a conversation with Peter Buchvar, and he was saying that that it's quite he was quite disappointed that Powell didn't address the 13% housing appreciation, and this is mostly due to the low interest rate environment that the Fed has just pushed. And this prices out new home buyers and a lot of people out of the market. And he was saying that this really is something that Powell missed addressing, but that was to one of your earlier points, Keith.
Yep. As the interest rate falls and asset prices rise and BlackRock is buying up all the housing because their cost of capital is lower. Mm-hmm. So, this is a chart of the gold basis. We publish on our website daily. And the green line, so we price the dollar in gold rather than pricing the gold in the dollar to add a little bit of clarity. But it's interesting that, Vincent, I think you talked about beginning of March. And this is, so March 8 is the high in the dollar measured in gold. It's at 18.5 milligrams, and so therefore the low in the gold price is right there. What we noticed since then is the price of the dollar is coming down, which means the price of gold going up until, you know, last week, early this week. What we see at the same time is a rising basis. So basis is the price of the futures contract minus the price of spot. And then quoted as an annualized return. And the reason why you do that is you know, a lot of traders can then think of borrowing, you know, borrowing cash in order to play this, buy spot, sell forward, make a few nickels or whatever. And the higher the basis gets, the more attractive it is to those, you know, market makers and arbitragers. But what's useful about this chart for, you know, for traders that are just following the gold market is you can see changes in supply and demand. The higher the basis, that means that the higher futures are relative to the spot. Futures are where the speculators are. Spot is being driven a lot more by buyers of metal, who are presumably a lot less leveraged or unleveraged stackers and much longer term holders. So if you see a rising basis along with a rising price of gold, that means the speculators are adding positions, making a bet, perhaps a bet on the Fed, you know, announcement, perhaps a bet on Basel, whatever it is, they're making a bet in the futures market. And it doesn't get much clearer than this. So here, when the price of gold hit its spike low on March 8, you know, we see a basis nearly zero. I mean, it's at 0.1%. And then there's been a steady rise. And then as of the 14th, is that Monday? You know, we see a basis of almost 0.6%. So a big move. This is a pretty stable spread that shouldn't move around that much. That's a pretty big move in a couple of months. And the driver of that move is people buying futures. And then I'm sure, so this is as of yesterday, you know, so we see the price of the dollar moving up today. I'm sure it'll, you know, obviously move up more. And I'm sure we're going to see the basis coming down. As you know, there's a flush, not of stackers generally, but the flush is going to be of, you know, leveraged longs in the futures market, flushing out today.
Hey, is that basis? Is that a 1 month London basis? Is that 1 year basis? What is that a basis of?
So we calculate this. This is a 6 month continuous basis. So,
but LBMA, like using GOFO or is this COMEX spreads?
We're actually, as far as I know, the only public source of GOFO at this point since they stopped quoting it in 2015. So we're calculating this as a spread between LBMA and COMEX.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, spreads blowing out is speculators getting in, and among other things, there's many other factors, but that's a sign of speculation, and that's.
But if I had to speculate on this, my guess would be that after today's action, we'll see this coming down to below 0.4%. that there would be that big flush, a whole bunch of selling of futures. And, you know, when you see that kind of hitting bottom, then that can be an indicator that, you know, price may have bottomed and now's the time to ride the next wave if you're, you know, trading gold for the short, you know, short-term trading.
And of course, we're recording this on the afternoon of June 17th. Over the last 2 days, we've seen gold almost drop $100 an ounce. And Bob, you wanted to bring up this volatility that we've been seeing and kind of give us an explanation for that.
Well, I'd like to hear Vincent's take on it because he's obviously in the heart of that business. I can give some perspective as well, but I'd like to get his opinion first.
Well, that's entirely unfair, Bob. I would just reiterate what I said before in the sense that you had the volatility. I write some posts for Zero Hedge. I contribute once in a while, and their financial stuff is very good. And there are people that are, you know, that there are people, and I'm not even referring to the conspiracy types, like, they're buying because it's going to go up. Okay, fine. That's great. Like it's GME or AMC or something. So when the market sold off the last 2 days, I was getting on my feed, I was getting information from two types. One type was it's selling off because the Fed is lying, you know, and they want to control whatever, right? And then the other type was it's selling off because there were too many people long. It was a crowded trade. And the psychology of gold, and I say this without wearing a tinfoil hat, the market structure of gold, it pays to be short if you're a bank. It just pays to be short. It was tier three. 50% of the capital you only needed for it. You know, you had producer business. The refiners were fragmented. The end users were fragmented. It just paid to play that game short. And my guess is, and this is actually something I had said on a broadcast that I do. I said, it doesn't feel like the kind of market you want to sell in the hole. Meaning, you don't want to sell down ticks. You don't want to spec from the short side. And I've been saying that for the last month. And then today we washed out, and someone said, "Well, Vince." The bullion banks were selling. I'm like, they probably weren't. But if they were, they were also buying it back. The sellers today and yesterday, the last couple of days of this move were funds in a crowded trade getting out for whatever reason. I can make a lot more of it, but that's really what it was to me.
Yeah, and that's what I've heard as well. I mean, you have not seen physical selling per se. Talking to all the players out there, this has been a futures driven, stop loss bonanza.
Absolutely, they love it. I mean, and you know, gold wasn't even. Gold was a big mover, but other markets moved. You know, catastrophically. You know, gold has been. Think about this. Gold has been going down when bonds are going down. It doesn't make sense, but. It does if you understand what's going on behind the scene with the flows. And we saw a big unwind of that. Gold sold off with bonds selling off and the dollar rallying at the same time. So for whatever mysterious reason that I understand, the funds said we have to get out.
Yeah, and if you want to add one other thing, if you look at the tips market is still rising and gold has hit the skids, whereas last year they were correlated almost 100%. It was a pretty strong correlation there. So there is a lot of what I've seen basically over the last 3 years, and I've talked to bigger players, is the larger high net worth investor has been the driver in this physical world. They've been plowing money into the market, reallocating their portfolios and saying, listen, I don't, with low interest rates, with high leverage or whatever it may be, gold seems like the right trade, whether it's because of uncertainty with taxation policies 5 years from now or inflation, where that's headed. You can't just simply, you know, the Fed passed $8 trillion on its balance sheet. I don't think we're ever going to see it, you know, draconianly or reduced in any material fashion. If they did, the whole thing would collapse. But there is a, that's why what I say is if you're on this, like I agree with Vincent, on the short side, on the longer term scale, you're going to be fighting basically the power of printing money every time there's a little hiccup in the system. They can try to manipulate short-term swings downward, you know, in the economy or try to cool inflation off temporarily, but they are the market at this point. That's what I think a lot of high net worth individuals, you know, that have come out over time, not just gold bugs per se, but a lot of big name guys that were in real estate or just portfolio managers that aren't, you know, they're adding gold to their position because of that uncertainty. And that's really the driver that I see that's the underlying current in this market.
And Bob, those buyers will tend to be strong hands. They're buying it for a long period of time.
Yeah.
For fundamental reasons. Can I ask you something, Vince? You mentioned that, you know, at the moment with the Basel rules that we've had, it just pays for the banks to be short.
It has.
Does that mean that the change in the Basel rules, decreases that incentive to be short?
Well, I think the way to answer this, so that I'm not speaking over my own intellect here, is to just say what I did. I took delivery of silver, not recently, but I've done it because I actually used to play the basis between spot and futures, right? So this is what Keith was talking about. In the silver market, because it was a thinner market, the funds would constantly pay up to roll in the last 30 days. And they would distort it well beyond the cost of carry. And I'm going to answer your question directly on that. And so I said, you know what? Being undercapitalized and all, I said, you know what? I'm going to take delivery. So I took delivery of 15 contracts of silver. Now, what happened was I was educating myself. I was a local on the floor and I didn't have the money to buy 15 contracts. So whatever the margin was, let's say it was $5,000 for one contract, I took delivery because I believed I took delivery and then I sold the second month because the spread was too big. So I wanted to capture the contango, which was too steep because the funds who can't take delivery were panicking, rolling over. And I said, you know what? I'll take 3 cents out of the market and I'll be happy. We'll see what happens. So I had the spread on and I was metal flat. I was price flat. And then first notice came and I took it. And then I got my delivery sheet and I was like, you know, it was like 20 years ago. And I'm like, oh my God, what does this mean? Right. And then I got a call from my clearinghouse. And they said, you need to come up with $1 million. And I didn't have that then. And I went, what do you mean? Can't I do it on margin? I didn't know anything, but they trusted me. I'm like, can I just, you know, no. This is a cash and carry trade. I wasn't taking delivery of it. It was in the vault. So this is me just being a naive kid who wants to learn. So I'm like, I'm not taking delivery of it. I just want to leave it in the vault. I'm only going to keep it for 30 days. Why don't you lend me the money? We're not allowed to. Like, well, and crap. So what did I do? I got out of my position. So as a person who doesn't have the facility to take delivery, who must come up with 100% cash in silver and 50% in gold, it doesn't behoove me because I can't borrow to take delivery. I can't, you know, I can't have it dropped off on my doorstep for 15, 20 contracts. So I recognized right then and there, I went, oh, wow. So these 2 cents that I'm making, these guys are doing that every month and making a dime. The point is, people like me have to roll. You know, I was deeper pocketed than the funds because that was all I was trading. I was paying attention to that very closely. But the banks have more capital, right? They borrow, their cost of capital is zero, let's say, effectively. My cost of capital is, you know, my Visa card, let's say, right? 18%. They've gotten rid of the usury laws. So 20%. So I can't take delivery because I don't have the cash and I can't borrow against it. They won't let me do that. I can't represent debt as equity. And so I made my 2 cents instead of five the hard way. And I went, oh, now I know why that going home short, if you're a bullion bank, means you're flat. You know, they don't, let's just say they have to put a 50% collateral and they don't anymore. They have to put up more, but they only have to have 50 cents on hand for every dollar of gold they're short. I have to have a dollar of gold on hand for every dollar of gold that I'm long. And so we used to see this, just to color this up, in 87, when the stock market just got obliterated, gold was called limit up in London and came in limit down. And that's because when the ship is sinking, they were throwing the good stuff away because they needed to get cash. And because I'm only getting 50 cents for this gold pen. So if I sell it, I'll get a dollar. It was a margin call. And that still works against people. So the banks are better off playing short because they know you can't play long.
Okay.
Just to highlight something you touched on, Vincent, the bank is flat price. They're long the contango or long the basis.
Right. They're long the put. They're short the futures. They're long. Right. Exactly. They're playing the.
They're long gold in some other form, typically a lease or a loan to.
Yeah, it's carry trades.
A refiner or something else, or maybe they have the bar. So they're short the contango in the market, but they're the market maker. Somebody wants to buy that thing. The bank is there to sell it to them. Otherwise, the futures price would be more volatile, perhaps like, you know, worst case scenario, rhodium. And, you know, then nobody would be able to trade it.
That's their business. I mean, they're natural shorts because of their business.
Right. I've got another call scheduled, so I'm going to have to run. But thanks, Tom, for having me. And
thanks for your time, Keith.
Again, and good to see you
good
again.
Good to see you, Keith.
Appreciate it.
Nice to meet you, Bob, and nice to meet you.
Yeah. Vincent. Nice meeting you, Keith.
All right. Take care.
Vince, I believe you got to go too.
I do. Do I have permission?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it, Vince.
Guys. Adrian, nice to see you again. And Bob, let's talk.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely.
Have a good week, guys. Be
thanks,
sure.
Vince. Thank you. Appreciate
you
it.
You too.
Thank you.
All right. One other thing I wanted to get your guys' opinion on, something that was brought up again in my research, trying to figure out which way this could go. Something that I kept falling over or kept seeing was that the BIS, some people were saying that the BIS could have instituted these changes due to pressure from Russia and China, considering that they're supposed to have massive gold reserves and they could want the US dollar to have less control in the world. So what are your thoughts towards this? Adrian, let's start with you.
Well, you know, I should start by saying that I'm a cynic, and I believe the governments in particular are capable of absolutely anything. So if we actually find out that governments did A, B, C, D, or E, I will believe it. But having said that, I also believe I apply Occam's razor to the world at large, not just to philosophy, meaning if there's a simple explanation for something, why are we looking for conspiracies? I mean, this is the first I've heard that. But my initial impression is Russia and China told the BIS to institute these changes so the price of gold go up and hurt the dollar, and incidentally hurt the Fed that doesn't value its gold reserves at market. That's just too much for me. I'm sorry.
Bob?
That's probably over my pay grade now. I can't. The only thing I could see is that the world, I mean, if you look at from 2013 to 2019 or 20, central banks had been net sellers of treasuries and net buyers of gold. And they were doing that obviously for a reason. And I think you've seen this shift. You know, we've got, you know, whether it's the petrodollar or less demand for dollars, less demand for U.S. Treasury debt and so forth. You know, there's an underlying current that's changing in the system. And you know, as You know, a lot of people worry that China may become the next dominant power, like, you know, they're where we were in the early 1900s. But you may see some type of, you know, with obviously the amount of debt that we have in the system, the Fed obviously is going to support asset prices as much as it can. Eventually, at some point, this whole thing starts to, it's like a top that's being spun that starts to wobble. Once it starts to wobble and loses control, you don't know where that volatility is going to lead you, but that's why I'm in it for gold and silver, because I see it as a in physical form. You're reducing so many risks that are out there that you just can't do it in a normal paper contract or even in a normal brokerage account. My concern would be the system's changing as we see it, and the Basel III thing is just another block that's being placed out there, you know, as part of that change to reduce. Because I think when inflation does rip, my concern is, along with others, is that if you're running a leveraged business and you're always, you know, if you're leasing metal, for example, and you're expecting that you can always get that metal back at some day, and the moment inflation really starts to hit hard and the public starts to wake up, says, "Oh my goodness, I got to own some metal," you won't be able to find it. And that's, that's why I think the players that are putting metal on the markets, you know, last year, they were playing the role, but at the same time, they're also not willing to give that metal up. Some of them, like our refiners, are simply just taking that metal back off the exchange and making product with it, and then selling that product at a higher premiums, because that's where the last 6 months or so, it's been advantageous for them to do that.
You know, the other thing I'd say, if I may, when I was reading about these Basel III changes, one thing that sort of, you know, suddenly hit me was, you know, if a bank has if you own unallocated gold at a bank, you don't own unallocated gold at a bank. That is the bank's asset. It's on the bank. It's a bank asset. Now, I'm not suggesting the banks are going bankrupt and you're going to lose your gold or anything else. But my gosh, if you buy an asset, namely gold, because it's an insurance, it's a hedge, it's a safety, it's the ultimate in safety, the last thing you want to do is put it unallocated at a bank where it's at risk. You know, I mean, buy whole physical, I've always said this to people, own physical metal at an independent storage company, whether it's in this country or abroad, sorry, but own it at an independent storage company. And if you're trying to trade it, by all means, buy an ETF, you know, but that's not an insurance policy. And I think these rule changes have reminded us of that, if we'd forgotten.
Yeah, and I think it's important that you just mention ETFs. If the market starts to constrict and the market makers, the banks, for instance, are becoming less and less, the participation and so forth, you know, you have to start worrying about the flow of the ETFs as well. And if institutions say, listen, if this friction or the spread costs start to become wider in trading ETFs, why not just go to the physical metal? And then on top of that, you know, for instance, here in the United States, you've heard about Biden talking about higher capital gains taxes, but not changing potentially the collectibles rate. So if they raise capital gain taxes, but not the collectibles rate, there's actually more of an advantage to own physical metal. And so those are all policies that start to play out over time. But I think high net worth investors are seeing all this on a larger scale and saying, listen, I don't know where the market's going to be, but I feel like the walls are closing in and I got to place myself out of harm's way.
No, absolutely. I think you made the excellent point about high net worth individuals, not just in the last few months, but over the last few years, deciding they need to own physical. And it's for a lot of people, it's just a sort of general sense, I think, but things just aren't really right. And gold is the ultimate asset to own when things are not right and they risk going belly up.
Yeah, and on top of this, we live in a world where, like with the reverse repos and this massive shortage of collateral, and that's why the reverse repurchase market is so grand, is because the U.S. Treasury has been paying down all their short-term T-bills. So at some point, gold may become a collateralized instrument for institutions to borrow against or put up as collateral. And I think that's where the COMEX is potentially leaning towards, is it's becoming more of a collateralized market, not necessarily a speculators and hedging market as much. And that's why, you know, you see the ratio at 2.65 physical or paper ounces to one physical ounce. That has just absolutely contracted from 2016.
Right.
And to your point, Adrian, something that we've touched on quite a few times on this show is, you know, people really getting rid of these unallocated or pooled accounts. That provides you no insurance policy, just as you said.
Right. I mean, I'm big in gold stocks. I'm big in exploration gold stocks. But I always tell people, don't think if you buy Ajax Exploration, it's an insurance policy. It's something totally different.
Absolutely. Yeah. Excellent, gentlemen. Well, I really appreciate your time. Do you have any thoughts that you'd like to add to this conversation before we wrap up here?
One thing I would probably mention, especially with all the volatility and the leverage, and especially if people want to start taking delivery, especially down the road, read the storage agreements, read your contracts, your user agreements with the programs you're dealing with. Understand the counterparty risk that you may be entering into. Those are important factors because I see a lot of firms out there, a lot of depositories that are getting into either the leasing or the lending business, and you don't know what their capitalization may be like, and that's happening on a global scale. So as people are trying to broaden out their revenue models, if they're undercapitalized, that could actually impact everybody in the vault, so to speak.
Right.
Adrian, do you have anything?
Well, my final word would just be: if you're a long term investor and you want gold as a protection, I mean, take advantage of this big sell-off.
Absolutely. All right, guys, I will add everybody's links to their websites, their Twitter handles, everything like that in the show notes. I really want to thank both of you and Keith and Vince for their time as well too today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.